Thank you very much. Thank you for the organizer for the invitation. What I want to start with is to give a little background on the general problem of the self-avoiding walk, because there's also going to be a session tomorrow with some interesting talks on the subject. Talk mainly about the self-avoiding walk in the integer lattice. So this is a model for polymer chains in a dilute solution. So it's basically something that's basically random with the one constraint that it can't have any self-intersections. So you model them by nearest neighbor random walk paths in the integer lattice. Just to give some notation here, we'll let script A sub n be the set of self-avoiding walks of length n with n steps starting at the origin. C sub n, the number of such walks. I may use A for the union of all possible finite length walks. A starting point for this is the simple observation that the number of walks of length n plus m is less than or equal to the number of times n times the number of times m. Basically, just a picture here. If I have an n step walk, an n plus m step walk, I have to have an n step walk and an m step walk. That may or may not produce a self-avoiding walk, but certainly balance the number of them. And that fact alone tells me that the number of walks grows exponentially. It isn't too difficult to give bounds on it. This number is somewhere between d and 2d minus 1. That's not known exactly what it is. D is the dimension. And so we have that the number of walks is equal to beta n times something, which goes to 1 over n power goes to 1. And also the submultiplicativity tells me that it's actually bigger than or equal to 1. And for those who are interested in more information about the self-avoiding walk, let me just put the major reference for rigorous results on the subject, Neil Madras and Gordon Slade's book, The Self-Avoiding Walk. There I defined what a walk was. To be probabilistic, we have to put a measure on walks. And there's two standard measures that one looks at. One is either to fix an n and look at the uniform measure on all walks of length n. Or another possibility is to look at walks of varying lengths, and you give a walk of length n measure b to the n, which is a parameter. And then we have measures which depend on b. The critical value is when that b is equal to 1 over beta, where beta was the connective constant from the last page. And that's exactly when this measure becomes infinite. That's easy to check based on things. So if it's less than infinity below that and equal to infinity above that. And I will be interested in either the measure, the uniform measure, or the measure mu, which is the critical measure on self-avoiding walks. And I may also look at it on walks that are not starting at the origin, so I may look at it. And roughly one would think that if we look at the constant to be bc minus 1 over n, then the typical walk has about n steps. So we tend to think of this measure and this measure as being similar. So the large n behavior of this is often looked at as the behavior of this as you approach BC from below. There are a number of conjectures about this that date back to Flory in the mid-20th century. One natural quantity to look at here I just mean the average value. So this is the average squared displacement of the random walk, and I have a sub n here. I mean using, say, the uniform measure on walks of length n. And this is supposed to behave a certain way, should be expected to be asymptotic to a constant times n to the 2 nu in small dimensions. We get a correction in four dimensions, n log n to the 1/4, and then of order n for d bigger or equal to 5. So this is the behavior you would get for simple random walk, because that's the squared being of order n means the typical displacement of order root n. And, well, b equals 1 is actually very easy. I'll leave that as an exercise. Nu 1 equals 1. nu 2 is expected to be 3/4 in two dimensions. Flory predicted 3/5 in three dimensions. That turns out to be, at least we believe now, that's probably wrong. Strong numerical evidence and some non-rigorous analytical evidence that it's incorrect. But we don't know what the exact value is. We may never know what it is exactly. Yeah. But mu bc minus 1 over n is a measure on walks of all possible lengths. And then you say, with respect to that yeah, that's, I'm sorry. That's probably, I should have said that normalized to be a probability measure. I really meant that normalized to be a probability measure. The typical walk under that measure is about n steps. That should have been normalized. That's a mistake. And for those who haven't seen this sort of stuff before, basically the central limit theorem basically tells us in some sense that simple random walk paths, simple means without the self-avoiding constraint, just normal random walk paths will tend to have dimension 2. And the critical and if I put it as self-avoiding constraint, the question is, well, if I have two two-dimensional sets, do they tend to want to intersect each other or not? And two random two-dimensional sets don't tend to intersect in more than four dimensions, and four is critical. So that's what led to the conjecture that self-avoiding walk is like ordinary random walk for d bigger than four, and maybe also for d equal to four. Now, for d bigger than four, this was proved in the 80s by a sequence of papers, Bridges and Spencer, first on a very closely related model, and then Slade, who developed that argument for the self-avoiding walk for high enough dimension, and then Harris Slade, who brought the dimension down to 5. And they proved that the self-avoiding walk in 5 or more dimensions does have the Brownian motion as its limit. Basically, it looks like random walk with just some slight change in the diffusion constant. This heuristic is fairly easy. This proof is not. This takes a lot of work. And the main tool in it is the Lace expansion. And in this case, the number of walks actually grows like beta to the n. To the constant. There's no correction there. Now, let me just put this back up. So, for some reason, I can't think of this f as being capitalized because on the next slide I have it capitalized for some reason. But f of n is the correction to the number of walks. So if I have that sort of, then c2n over cn times cn, just by definition of this correction term, gives me f of 2n over f of n squared. But cn over c 2n over cn times cn is also, if you just think about it, the probability that two random self-avoiding walks can be put together without a self-intersection. That means, so this is really, this is the probability that two self-avoiding walks of length n at the origin do not intersect, assuming they're chosen independently from the uniform distribution. And that gives some ideas to what you might expect this quantity to look like. Just in comparison, if instead of having self-avoiding walks, I had simple walks, I asked what's the probability two simple walks of length n don't have any self-intersections. These are all rigorous results. It looks like n to the minus 1 for d equals 1. That's actually just the gambler's ruin estimate. N to the minus 2/3 for d equals 2. That's a much harder thing, proved a couple of years ago, Oded, Schramm, Benlin, Berner, and myself. In d equals 3, it's known it behaves like n to the minus zeta for some number zeta, but the exact number is not known. It's of the order about 0.29. This is rigorous. That's numerical. For d equals 4, it goes to 0 logarithmically with a power of minus a half. Then for d greater or equal to 5, it's not too difficult to show that, in fact, there's a positive probability two infinite simple walks don't intersect. In comparison, let's forget d equals 1 for self-avoiding walks. For self-avoiding walks, the Harris-Slade result proved that it is C for D greater than equal to 5. It's conjectured to be log n to the minus a quarter for D equals 4. For D equals 2, a prediction came out the first time by Nienhuis in the early 80s that predicted n to the minus 11 over 32. And for D equals 3, it's expected to be to follow a power law, but with no particular guess as to what the power is.
I'm curious,
are
people about the
11:30? Very. And in fact, I'll discuss the 11:30 seconds more. It's correct. That does not mean I proved it. The self-avoiding polygon is similar to a self-avoiding walk, except that it's a loop. The term polygon is standard in the literature. You might also want to say self-avoiding loops if you wish. It's basically a self-avoiding walk with no self-intersections, except that it comes back to where it is, to where it started. So it's a self-avoiding walk of two n steps with the same initial and ending point, or it's a two n minus one step thing. That should be W0 minus W, omega 0 minus omega 2n minus 1 equals 1. And let me let U2n be the set of self-avoiding polygons of length 2n with omega 0 equals 0. And then it has the same behavior in terms of the exponential here, but the corrections are different. I should also say that self-avoiding polygons are sometimes counted slightly differently. For instance, Madras and Slade count it differently in their book. Here I've written a polygon, but I haven't shown you where the origin is. The origin might be there, might be there, might be there. Under my count, if the origin's in a different place, that gives you a different self-avoiding polygon. As counted by some other people, that might give you the same self-avoiding polygon, so you factor this. And you can also go counterclockwise or clockwise around it, which would give you another two. So there's three natural ways of counting the number of self-avoiding polygons. You just have to be a little careful when reading literature which one the people are doing. And none is intrinsically better than the other, I don't think. Okay. And intuitively, you can think of the number of self-avoiding polygons over the total number of self-avoiding walks of 2n as the probability that the self-avoiding walk is at the origin. And this would give you at least some reason to believe that you would expect a power law correction, that this should be a power law less than this, at least in the comparison. Okay, so that's some general talks about these things. Now I want to restrict myself to D equals 2 and talk about the conjectured scaling limit for D equals 2, and most of what I'm going to talk about here is joint work with Oded Schramm and Wendland Berner, the majority of which is actually in a preprint that's been out for a couple of years but hasn't appeared in print. It will actually appear probably the next year in a AMS volume of papers in a conference for Benoit Mandelbrot. We'll talk D equals 2. I gave you some conjectures on what this should be and what this should be. That's conjectured to be 3/4. That's conjectured to be, 43 over 32 is gamma. Gamma minus 1 would be conjectured to be 11 over 32. But at this moment, I want to show you how you might derive these numbers without knowing them. So right now, let's just assume that we have this behaves like n to the 2 nu, and this behaves like beta to the n, n to the gamma minus 1. That may look a little funny to write gamma minus 1, but if you think of it this way, if I look at the measure of the set of walks in the critical measure of length n to 2n, then that's n to the gamma, because I just basically, it's n to the gamma minus 1 times n. So number of walks of the critical measure of the number of walks of size of length n to 2n is like n to the gamma. But we take scaling limits it's actually more natural to talk about the number of self-avoiding walks that have diameter between r and 2r. And basically, if we talk about how many self-avoiding walks should there be with diameter between r and 2r, that should be r to the gamma over nu, because the typical number of steps is, if it's diameter r, that's r to the 1 over nu steps. Right now I'm waving, at this point for a while I'm just going to be waving my hand. I also want to define one other exponent, and this term, this is not so standard notation, but the probability that self-pointing walk of length n stays in the upper half plane in a platform is going to be n to the minus rho. Think of that as being a definition of the exponent rho. Or if it's diameter r, the chance it stays in the upper half plane should be minus rho over nu. Okay, now we're going to wave our hands a little bit. Okay, what I've drawn here is think of it as an n by n square in the square lattice. And I've taken 2 points on the boundary. Think of them as being opposite each other and in the middle. I don't want any of the boundary effects in here. And I'm looking at the set of self-avoiding walks starting here, starting here, ending there, and staying in the square. And let's think of how many there are, given that the exponents exist. Well, the claim is that the mu measure of the set of such paths should be comparable to n to the minus 2 over a. Well, basically, minus 2a satisfies this. And let's just very quickly go through this to show you what's okay. I try to see how many walks start here and end there. They should be walks of diameter n, approximately, or maybe n to 2n. So the number of walks of diameter n to 2n, approximately, would be n to the gamma over nu. That's how many total walks, starting at that point. I want them to end at z. They're about n squared points, so an n to the minus 2 to say that it ends at z. And now, this one also has to stay above here, and this one has to stay below there. And that gives me n to the minus 2 over rho, and that should be, that's rho over nu. I noticed that as I was appropriating my notes. It should be. So that's, the rho over nu is the exponent to stay in an upper half plane, and I have two of them, because I have two there. So, that's heuristic, but you would expect, and I just defined that to be 2a, because it's convenient. So that's a boundary-to-boundary picture. Now we want to do a boundary-to-interior picture. Right, and basically that should be of order 1. That would only affect, that shouldn't affect the exponent. Basically, if you cross the square, a solid fraction of them wouldn't want to go out to there. Yeah, maybe I shouldn't have mentioned. Yeah, I'm only doing things up to the exponent, not too precisely. Do the same picture, except that I'm doing an interior point to a boundary point. I called the last one minus 2a, which you think would be minus a minus a. I'm going to call this exponent minus a minus b. Just same a, different, and if I call it that. Again, the number of walks looks like this. Again, a minus 2 because I have to end at z. And then I have a stays in the half plane factor. But here I only stay in the half plane on one side, not on both sides. So what I've done is basically define two numbers, a and b, as functions of the critical exponents gamma, nu, and rho. And now I want to take a scaling limit. So suppose I was going to take a scaling limit. So I don't really have everything in this picture, so you'll have to leave it to your imagination. So I now work in C, and I take some domain D. So this gives me some domain D. And now I imagine what I'm going to do is I put a very fine lattice inside this domain D. And then when I put a very fine lattice, I can then look at little self-avoiding walks in this fine lattice. I can ask, what's the mu measure of the set of walks going from Z to W in this fine thing? Well, if the scaling is 1 over n, then if we believe the heuristics, then the total mass should be 1 n to the minus 2a. That was the definition. So what I'm going to do is multiply the measure by n to the 2a and hope to have a limit. So I'm saying, so if I have a limit of these measures, I should have to multiply by n to the 2a, and then I have a chance of having a limiting measure on continuous paths. They're actually non-intersecting. That's non-self-intersecting. That's not obvious why they should be, but the reason to believe it. And connecting boundary points. They neither touch themselves nor do they touch the boundary anyplace else, and that's not obvious. Okay. Right, they do, exactly. So that's exactly, okay, I don't really want to discuss that. Yeah, I mean, I could give reasons, I mean, there are reasons for it, although that, like virtually everything else, everything I'm talking about in terms of the limit is only heuristic. But the reason, there is good reason to believe that gives you a simple path that doesn't touch the boundary except at the endpoints. Actually, not touching the boundary and not touching itself are almost equivalent situations here. And now, theoretical physicists have put self-avoiding walk in one of the categories of things whose limits should be conformally invariant. Now, exactly what they mean by this was never written too clearly in the literature. Here we'll make a precise statement about what we mean, what we expect this limiting thing to have. And it's something we'll call here a conformal covariance. So we have this limit. This is a limit. Okay, let me talk about this. We took a limit. When we took this limit, we multiplied by n to the 2a. We expect that this measure here will be finite if I have a bounded domain D. And let's assume that the boundary is smooth near Z and W. Then we get a finite measure, non-zero measure, but the actual total mass of this measure will depend on D, Z, and W. This is not a probability measure. It's a finite measure, but not necessarily a probability measure. And generally will not be a probability measure. Because I use the same n to the 2a is always used regardless of what d is. I don't put any extra constants in there. Then the conjecture is I have conformal covariance. So I have the domain, so I have the domain d, and I map it conformally to another domain. Basically, what conformal covariance says that the measure here will go to a measure there. If I normalize this to be a probability measure and normalize this to be a probability measure, the probability measure over here would be exactly the same as the probability measure over here. However, they're not probability measures, and in fact, the total mass does get scaled, and it gets scaled by a certain amount, and it's based on the derivative of the mass at these two points. Now, this multiply by n to the 2a, I'll leave this for you to do for yourself. If you just took a square as your domain, and you took two points there, the square can be easily approximated by finer and finer discrete things. And if you did that n to the minus 2a, when I did it at level n, it would be n to the 2a. At level 2n, it would be 2n to the 2a. A factor comes out that you have to deal with. And in that case, you could see that that's actually the factor that you would have to get. But in general, it's believed that the factor looks like that. And this world of conformal covariance as opposed to invariance is used here to say that there's a scalar correction to the measure.
So
That is part of the statement. Not if you normalize, no. I mean, this has two pieces. One is that if you normalize them to be probability measures, one is the image measure of the other. And the other is the total mass of the measure moves by a certain amount. No. No, because you could just define it to be whatever you wanted it to be. I mean, if you define the probability measures to be what you want, and then on your domains, then on any particular domain, arbitrarily decide what the total mass is going to be. Okay, right. That will not imply that you have this rule for the total masses. Right. There's a similar thing for the interior to boundary. My W is an omega, look a lot alike. That's a W there. So now imagine I have an interior point and a boundary point. Again, we're going to scale this thing down so it has, so we hope to have a limiting measure. Now we have to multiply by n to the a plus b. And we have the same sort of rule. If I have a conformal transformation, take this measure, map to that measure, I would expect this sort of behavior like this. And here I now have the scalar correction is based on the derivatives of the maps of the two points, but I don't say that the boundary and the interior have the same value necessarily. So that's the boundary thing and that's the interior thing. And we think of A and B as being scaling exponents here. Now there's another property that the limit obviously satisfies if the limit exists. Of course, we don't know where the limit exists, but if the limit exists, it has a certain property known as the restriction property. Remember that the limit is done by taking, we just took all walks from there to there, staying in the domain, and just look at the total measure of all those walks, all the possible walks, and took the limit, scaled by an n to the 2a. If I made a smaller domain, I took the same limit in the smaller domain, I could do things in either or. Either I could take the limit in the larger domain and then restrict to the paths in the smaller domain, or I could just take the limit in the smaller domain. In other words, the measure on the smaller domain is just the measure on the larger domain restricted to the smaller domain. Here I'm using the restricted, not conditioned on. These are not probability measures. So the total mass in the smaller domain is smaller than the total mass in the larger domain. And that should be true in both the boundary to boundary and interior to boundary cases. Right now I'm assuming I'm cutting the domain away from the points of interest. Those are basically the assumptions I'm going to make. What sort of limits would have the properties that would satisfy the conformal covariance and the restriction property? Well, if it satisfies these things, then we can look at the following quantity. I like to use mu d sharp for the probability measure. So mu d sharp is just mu d normalized to be a probability measure. So let's look at the paths. If these things exist, then the probability measures would satisfy what's called the conformal Markov property. And what's the conformal Markov property? I'll just do it in the boundary to boundary case, and it's similar to the two cases. So I've got a measure on points, on paths connecting two boundary points. Suppose I've seen a certain amount of the path so far. So I've seen the red part. I want to know what's the distribution of the green part given the red part. Well, what I do is I map the slit domain, the domain minus the red part, conformally back to the original domain, and for ease, let's send it these two points to where they were sent before. Then any measure here corresponds to a measure there on paths from there to there, and the conformal Markov property is in fact that this measure is exactly the same thing as that which we started with. And now we're going to talk, and here's a rigorous, so now we're going to talk about a rigorous fact about continuous things. The only distribution on simple curves, or actually sort of families of distributions, mu, d, z, w, satisfying the conformal Markov property and the restriction property is that given by something called the Schramm-Lerner evolution with parameter 8/3. So these assumptions that we've made have said there's only one possible limit for this thing. If this exists, only one. I don't really have a time to talk about SLE in detail, but let me say a little bit about it. Let me define at least in the chordal case, half-plane case. I'll discuss a little more toward the end of the talk. But let me look at what happens. Let's look at the measure, the probability measure on paths starting at the origin going to infinity. So I've got some measure, and I've got this path. One thing I'm not worrying about right now is the exact parameterization of the path, and I'm going to make a statement which holds for a particular parameterization of the path. But suppose, if there's a particular parameterization of this path, which has the following property. Suppose I stop it at time t, so that's gamma of t, and I define gt to be the conformal transformation of the half plane minus the slit to the upper half plane with certain boundary conditions. Basically, that actually gives all the boundary conditions. Infinity goes to infinity, the derivative of infinity is 1, and there's one other constant, the constant term at infinity is 0. So that's actually all that explicitly says what GT is, given the conformal transformation. Then the distribution of GT, well, basically, you can write a differential equation for GT. The time derivative of GT of Z is given by this formula. And it's just 3/4 over GT of Z plus BT, G0Z equals Z. This isn't quite how it's normally written, but it's actually the more convenient for computing purposes. Most of the time, people have been writing a minus sign here, but minus a Brownian motion and plus a Brownian motion have the same distribution, so it doesn't make any difference. And I've done the parameterization, so for those who know what it means, the capacity grows at rate 3/4 t rather than at rate 2 t, which some other things have done. But instead of having a constant here, I put the constant up there. The conformal Markov property and Schramm-Lerner evolution allows you to put any parameter here. 3/4 is the only parameter, which gives you a simple curve such that the things satisfy the restriction property. So this says SLE 8/3 should be our guess for our limit. Okay. The only other possible candidate would be SLE 6, which can be ruled out for a couple of reasons. Let me just tell you, SLE 6 would give you a hull that was the size of Brownian motion. So if you believe self-avoiding walks are smaller than Brownian motions, that would be enough. SLE is for, yeah. This turned out to be the boundary of percolation. So it's not really assumed, yeah. Once you decide it's not Brownian motions, it's something smaller than that, this is the only thing. Percolation clusters, the hull of percolation clusters and the hull of Brownian motions have the same distribution. Okay. So now we know that SLE 8/3 is the only limit, assuming all these assumptions. What can we say about SLE 8/3? Well, one thing is that the Hausdorff dimension of the paths of SLE 8/3 is not obvious, but if you can just compute it, it turns out to be 4/3. There's a parameter in SLE, and as you change that parameter in SLE, you change the Hausdorff dimension of the paths. SLE 8/3 is the unique SLE, which gives dimension 4/3. But we're going the other way, where we figured out it had to be SLE 8/3, that gives us dimension of the paths as 4/3. Now, if you think about the dimension of the paths, that's how many points do you visit. That means think of it in n steps, in radius r, I would tend to have r to the 4/3 points. If I convert that to nu is basically 1 over that number. That's just, now we're being heuristic. When we go back to discrete, we're being heuristic. But that should correspond to nu equals 3/4. That's giving nu equals 3/4 just from the behavior of the limit. There are various ways that you can also compute A and B. What are the scaling exponents for SLE 8/3? And I won't go into them too much, but I'll just say you can compute them precisely. And it's A equals 5/8 and B equals 5/48. And I've just written one of the kinds of things that you can get. For instance, if I took this is the radial, this is an SLE from 0 to Z, SLE 8/3, and ask what's the probability that an SLE 8/3 avoids a set there, it's given basically in terms of the derivatives of these two points. And this 5/48 and that 5/8 are exactly those scaling exponents. Now, if you remember, we wrote A and B as a function of nu, gamma, and rho. But now nu is 3/4. So now we have two equations in two unknowns, gamma and rho, and we can solve them. And solving them, you get that. And that's the 43 over 32, which is the 11 over 32. Okay. Well, that's talking about self-avoiding walks. Actually, self-avoiding polygons are actually somewhat easier to deal with and perhaps are the better way to get toward results, rigorous results. I want to talk a little bit about polygons. First, there's a result called hyperscaling, and this is just, I shouldn't say result, this is just a heuristic belief, but it has a heuristic proof. If I look at how many self-avoiding polygons are there, well, the number of self-avoiding polygons, and this is in B dimensions, is, well, if you have two n steps, you have to have n steps times n steps. So we start them both at the origin. The two of them have to end at the same point. That says they end at the same point. Plus, they can't have intersected each other. And there's actually two places they might want to intersect each other, at the beginning and at the end. So that sort of says the beginnings don't intersect and the ends don't intersect. So we have this belief. This is not a proof, but that the, so we actually have that this exponent should be n to the minus 3/2. If I take a circle of radius r, say, we'll look at, say, like the mu measure of the set of self-avoiding polygons of diameter r to 2r, and here I mean that include the origin in the interior. So how many of them are there that encompass the origin? The mu measure of that should be like r to the 1 over nu. And that's using my way of counting self-avoiding polygons, which is sort of the rooted way. if I use unrooted things, well, this is of diameter r, should be about r to the 1 over nu points. If I count all those as being equivalent, I actually get that the number of unrooted self-supporting polygons has measure of order 1. So in fact, if I take unrooted self-supporting polygons in this thing, the belief is there's actually no polynomial correction. So we could ask, what's the measure of that you get with when you take limits like this? Now we're waving hands again, and we'll talk about the self-avoiding polygon loop soup. And it would be the scaling limit of these self-avoiding polygons of all different sizes. So we have big ones, small ones, and things. In the limit, if you sort of subtract out the single points, and so what I'm doing here, maybe I should say a little bit more here. I'm taking, say, a ball, maybe just a radius 1, making a very fine lattice here, and putting all the possible self-avoiding polygons, and giving them all the mu measure. Then I fix some macroscopic size. I look at only those of size epsilon or bigger. Take the limit as the lattice spacing goes to 0, and then I should have a measure, which is not necessarily a probability measure, on loops of diameter epsilon or bigger. And then I let epsilon go to 0. And then I should have an infinite measure on loops of various different sizes. They should be. This is really a Poissonian realization from this. These are just all possible, a bunch of self-avoiding loops. In fact, but this measure should actually satisfy conformal invariance. This lack of polynomial correction tells me we go from covariance to invariance. So, if I take a conformal image of this, it should transform exactly. It should also satisfy the restriction property. If I took a smaller set and restricted myself to curves on a smaller set, it should just give the same thing. By the way, if you want to think for a second, if I've got a measure that has conformal invariance and the restriction property, it better be infinite or zero or something. You can't have probability measures that are both conformally invariant and satisfy restriction, because restriction gives you smaller measures, but you can conformally map into that domain. So in order to get conformal invariance and restriction simultaneously, we naturally get to the realm of infinite measures. They're allowed to overlap. This is really just a measure on loops. Yeah. That's another interesting topic, which is maybe next year's round of talks. But not this year's. Well, it's a measure on the loops, and the soup is just a Poissonian realization from that measure. So it's really just a measure. One could do the same thing with random walks, just simple random walks, or Brownian motions. We do a simple random walk case. Let's split this up into size things of size 1 over n, just a small scaling. And then every simple random walk of 2n steps, we give measure, 1/4 to the 2n, that's equivalent of the beta to the minus n, but that's just the probability of doing the loop. And that's a 2n to the minus 1, only because I want to make them unrooted. That's the probability starting at this point that I do it, but I want the unrooted loop to have that measure, so I do rooted loops times that. In work I've done with a grad student, Jose Trillo Ferraz, we showed that at the limit of this approaches something which is called the Brownian loop soup, which I had discussed in a paper with Bendel and Werner, and we have a measure on Brownian loops, and conjecture is that self-avoiding polygons and Brownian loops have the same limit. Now, I don't mean that in the sense, if I take a Brownian motion, you don't need to put the light on it. If I take a Brownian motion path, it looks like that. But then for the Brownian motion path, I can take the outer boundary of it. And if I have a measure, the Brownian loop soup, I get a measure on outer boundaries like this. And the conjecture is that the self-avoiding, the polygon loop measure is the same as the Brownian loop measure. It is known that the Hausdorff dimension of the outer boundary of Brownian motion loops is 4/3. By the way, since historically, in the late 70s, early 80s, in his book Geometry, Fractal Geometry of Nature, Mandelbrot was the first one to make the numerical observation that the boundaries of Brownian motions have the same sort of behavior as self-avoiding walks, seem to look like them. That's one of the reasons why this particular paper was submitted to a journal in his honor. Okay. Let me discuss these conjectures in another way. Let's try to be probabilistic. The self-avoiding walk is hard for a number of reasons, probabilistically. It's not a process. Probabilists like processes. Things, you've gone for a while, and then you know your probability of your next step. The self-avoiding walk, as I stated, is more combinatorial, or maybe statistical physics, configurational statistical physics, equilibrium statistical physics. But there is a natural quantity, or a couple of natural quantities in it, which are processes. And the one that's called the infinite, I'll call it the infinite self-avoiding walk. And this is just conjecture. But what I want to do is take a very long self-avoiding walk, but only look at its first n steps. So you have take a very long walk. Or to be precise, what I want to do is give the measure of this walk is the limit as m goes to infinity of the number of walks that start here over the total number of walks. If the limit exists, then in fact, this will give you a well-defined process on infinite self-avoiding walks. May not be easy to describe. It'll have non-Markovian transition probabilities. Your probability of your next step will depend on your entire past, but it would give you a certain process. The limit's not known to exist except for d greater than or equal to 5, where the lace expansion techniques can be used to show it exists. And the conjecture, I'll just say, is that the scaling limit of this is supposed to be what's called whole plane SLE 8/3. I didn't say what whole plane SLE 8/3 is, but it's basically radial SLE 8/3, where you think of this as your boundary point, and infinity as being your point in the interior that you're going to, and you try to go like that. Similarly, one could talk about an infinite half-plane self-avoiding walk, where you do the same sort of game, except that you require the path to be in the upper half-plane. So you ask how many upper half-plane walks start like that. As it turns out, one can actually show in the half-plane case that this limit exists. Unfortunately, the proof doesn't help you understand the limit at all, but you can actually prove the limit exists. And this gives a measure on infinite self-avoiding walks staying in the upper half plane. The conjecture is this is the scaling limit is chordal SLE 8/3. The half plane SLE 8/3. In reality, I think neither of these is the best thing to be looking at. What one really ought to be looking at is the infinite self-avoiding polygon. Not trivial. What do you mean trivial? You mean the proof to show they exist? Limit Brownian motion. Yeah, if it's in any dimension, if it didn't give you the same limit, the bulk of it looks the same as the path. Yeah, it just takes away some of the boundary effect at the end. And now I want to take the boundary effect on both sides. Actually, an infinite self-avoiding polygon. Polygons have the advantage they don't have ends. A lot of the problems with self-avoiding walks have to do with ends. The self-avoiding polygon, take the middle of a self-avoiding polygon, you don't know what part of the polygon you're in anyway, so they're all equally middle-ish. But if you want to take an infinite one, basically what you're doing is you're taking two infinite self-avoiding walks conditioned not to intersect each other. So you can play the same game as I was doing for the infinite walks, except that what you want to do is you take for any pair omega 1 and omega 2, we look at all the ways that you can extend it in both directions. This limit also is not known to exist. You can also do a half-plane version of it, and actually the half-plane one's not known to exist at the moment either. The conjecture for this is that this should converge to two-sided whole-plane SLE 8/3. Now that's something that's not written down in any paper right now, so maybe I ought to explain what that is. But I have just a little bit about time. I'm going to explain things a little bit by picture. So I'm going to talk about the three processes. The last two processes. I'm going to talk about, the first and third. The whole plane SLE and two-sided SLE. So this whole plane SLE that I mentioned, so this should be the limit of one self-avoiding walk. And even though this picture is in the half plane, that's unintentional. This is not supposed to be. I'm not doing the half plane case here. So how does this progress? Let me just say how you think about this. Suppose I've seen a certain amount of the curve. There actually is a little bit of detail about how to get started. But let's suppose I've gotten myself started, and I want to know how the rest of the curve goes. Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this piece here, actually I'm going to take the complement of this and map the complement of this to the complement of the unit disk, complement of the closed unit disk. So GT is a map taking the complement of this line to the complement of the unit disk. And this point here gets mapped someplace and it's on the unit disk. And I'm just calling that point on the unit disk right now e to the minus iut, where ut is a real, so ut would be on the real line. And I want to write the derivative of this, but I prefer things on the real line. Let me write HT for I log GT. This is just makes things on the real line. There's an equation that this satisfies. And it's basically just that HT dot of Z is given by 4/3 cotine HTZ plus UT over 2. So these are things if Z is actually on the real line, if this were X, we think of these as being something on the real line, except this is all mod 2 pi. We're only taking cotangents, so this is really on a circle, mod 2 pi. And the input is a Brownian motion. So BT is a standard Brownian motion. I just called it UT for, okay. So you start with a standard Brownian motion, you solve an equation, and you get the behavior of a path. I only used that the endpoint was on the exterior, which would be true for all SLEs. So what I wrote there could be done for any SLE. This next slide, for those who know other values of SLE, forget them. Now I'm going to start. That's one step before I wanted to do this first. Okay. This is something which requires SLE 8/3 only. And that's how to growing. What I want to do is grow two SLEs. And growing two SLEs with interactions is a subtle thing to do. And you can do something in the SLE 8/3 case you can't do in other cases. But let me just show you what's happening. So what I'm now trying to do is draw two curves. And again, if I look at these two curves at some point, I can map the slip domain, the domain minus those two pieces, to the domain away from the unit disk, and then I have this point is mapped somewhere, and this point is mapped somewhere. Then basically, again, I'm just taking the logarithm. Don't worry about the form of the equation. I'll just say, basically, you get an equation for this thing in terms of these two quantities. And now, before we put in Brownian motions, well, in this case, they're going to be interacting Brownian motions. What you do is you show that basically this is given by, well, it could be I put a 1 over square root 2 just because of the way I scaled it. This acts like a Brownian motion repelled away from the other Brownian motion. So now these two guys move around in the unit circle, but with a particular repulsion that keeps them from hitting. And it's exactly, there are ways of designing it so that it works out. There's also an equation for it. Suppose you wanted one side of the two-sided SLE 8/3. So it's the same thing I did in the last slide, except I'm only looking at one side of it. Well, then there's an equation for that. Basically, any particular time, we can map it back. I mean, I'm not forgetting this point. So it gets mapped someplace over there. And now I solve this equation. In this case, the green point does not have any stochastic term. It just moves differentially. That one has a stochastic term. It's way too much to try to look at those equations, but I just one picture I want to give you is sort of, is that I'm trying to draw a two-sided path. When I'm trying to draw a two-sided path, I could say, well, let me grow this side for a while. Now let me grow this side for a while. And keep going back and forth. In this particular case, using these equations, they're perfectly set up, I can grow them in either order and get the same distribution. And that's something particular to kappa equals 8/3. It has to do with the restriction property. Just for those who know what that means, it's a very SLE 8/30 thing to do. That you can actually grow this thing in any direction. It also has the property, suppose you've done it, and you've got the entire first path, and you say, okay, I know what the half of the SLE looks like. What does the other half look like? The other half is actually chordal SLE. Once this is here, infinity is now a boundary point of this domain, so I can do chordal SLE. And in fact, that's the way to think of chordal SLE. You've done the path up to a certain point. Chordal SLE is if you've given half the path and you want to know how the rest of the half is going to go, you basically do it that way. So I've gone this way, but think of this as being actually the past of the self-avoiding walk, two-sided self-avoiding, and that's the future. Given the past, the future acts like chordal SLE. Okay, time is up, so that's enough of this. Let me just end. If I talk, give some overview. If I had to list the three major problems right now in self-avoiding walk, first is, establish rigorously that SLE 8/3 is the scaling limit of lattice self-avoiding walk in B equals 2. We are very far from having an idea about what to do this. However, to advertise one of the talks for tomorrow, Tom Kennedy has done many simulations testing this theory, and you'll have to come tomorrow to find out how they did. Second is, in four dimensions, show that self-avoiding walk approaches Brownian motion. There's interesting work being done in this and various related models. If you're interested in this topic, go to David Bridges' talk tomorrow. Unfortunately, no one is talking about the third topic, which I think is also, maybe even the hardest. In So in two dimensions, we now have a candidate for the limit of two-dimensional walks, but we can't prove it. In four and more dimensions, the limit is Brownian motions, even though we haven't proved it in four dimensions. Can we construct a candidate for the limit in three dimensions? Something which would have this right funny fractal dimension, or something like that. So find a process in R3 which would be the candidate. Okay, and thank you, that's where I was.